abrupt manner. He introduced himself. He assured them of his support for Governor Roberts and for ratification. They could count on him. Cat wanted to set off on her road tour with a strong tailwind of positive publicity. By Saturday, with pledge results from the Roving League deputations trickling in, Cat decided that the legislative poll was complete enough and positive enough to announce that Tennessee was certain to ratify. It was a stretch, she knew. The poll was still incomplete and still unstable, but she was willing to make the leap. Going public with the poll might make it harder for legislators to slink out of their pledges later, might encourage hesitant ones to jump off the fence and join the winning side. It was blue-sky optimism, and she was an optimist. Cat and Marjorie Schuller quickly sketched out a press release, declaring that a majority vote for ratification was clinched. "Suffrage is all the rage now," Cat asserted with confident elan. Politicians gravitate toward success, she knew. Her analysis was mostly anecdotal, of course, based upon scattered intelligence from those with their ears to the ground or their shoes in the mud of the districts, chasing their lawmakers. But it was also based upon assurances from knowledgeable Tennessee political men, such as Congressman Cordell Hull, who consulted with Cat over the weekend. Cat wanted to make it seem as though a tipping point had already been reached, and ratification was sliding smoothly downhill to victory. Cat was also cheered by the arrival of Ann Dallas Dudley, back home from the Democratic Convention. Dudley had long been the beautiful face and charming ambassador of the movement in Tennessee, a silky secret weapon. Bringing her wealth, social prominence, and Southern bona fides to the side of the cause, she'd made suffrage respectable in Nashville. She'd founded the Nashville Equal Suffrage League and had served as head of the Tennessee Suffrage League. Even more important, she was the Suff's best answer to the usual anti-depiction of suffragists as ugly and masculine she-men, unhinged and unsexed. Soft-focus photographs of Dudley reading to her adorable young children, the perfect maternal scene, were published and circulated by the Tennessee Suffs, even long after Dudley's children grew out of the nursery, as an antidote to the anti-disparagements. Even Dudley's businessman husband was a good suffragist, always in the forefront of any men for women suffrage activity. Now he was on the men's ratification committee. Cat felt better knowing that Ann Dudley would be holding down the fort in Nashville while she was away. On Sunday night, July 25th, Cat, Abby Milton, and Marjorie Schuller departed Union Station on the overnight train to Memphis. Before they left, the press release announcing an assured victory in Tennessee went out to the local and national newspapers and all the wire services. It would appear in the Monday papers. More than a majority of both Tennessee Senate and House are pledged to the ratification of the federal suffrage amendment, the statement read. The National Association was able to announce the completion of the poll so early, owing to the splendid performance of our Tennessee members, Carrie Catt proclaimed. We are rejoicing over the results of our work so far, Abby Milton, state president of the League of Women Voters, was quoted as saying, but we intend to continue just as strenuously during the 2 weeks intervening before the special session, because we want the vote for ratification to be as nearly unanimous as possible. As the three suffrage missionaries lay in their Pullman berths, rocked by the rhythm of pistons turning wheels, there were many matters to trouble their minds and disturb their sleep. Among these was the article Marjorie had clipped from the front section of the Sunday Morning Banner, headlined, Asks Mrs. Cat to Explain Statement. It was the Banner's publication of Mrs. Pinkard's attack letter. A strange way for Major Stallman's paper to express support for the amendment. Nevertheless, Mrs. Cat's words of sanguine certainty on ratification were rolling through printing presses around the country as she hurtled through the night on the Nashville-Memphis Express. Chapter 13. Prison Pin. It's all bluff, Sue White fumed on Monday morning. She just scanned the Nashville Tennessean and found Mrs. Katz's press release. It was preposterous. Impossible that a majority had pledged favorably. Certainly not yet. She was conducting the Woman's Party's own poll of the legislature and finding that getting straight answers, much less positive pledges, was akin to pulling teeth from a bear. And now there were the 13 new wild cards, the candidates running to fill vacancies in the legislature in the special election on primary day, August 5th. They could swing the ratification count one way or the other, and that cohort was still a mystery. Kat was dreaming. Or playing some fibbing game. Or both. White was running on adrenaline. Her nerves jangled and her mind racing since she'd returned to Nashville late on Friday night, July 23rd. During the previous 10 days, she'd traveled more than 1,600 miles, back and forth and again to Ohio, the pulsing hiss of locomotive steam still ringing in her ears. Those 10 days were a high-speed blur, a whirl of presidential candidates, handlers, boosters, and banners. Now her tough work was beginning. Over the weekend, she found a storefront to serve as Woman's Party campaign headquarters, a good spot in the heart of downtown with big windows facing busy 6th Street. It was just half a block from the Hotel Hermitage and a quick walk to the Capitol building. A storefront headquarters was so much better than a hidden hotel suite. It made a big, bold statement that the Woman's Party was a distinct and substantial force in the ratification campaign, and not shy about saying so. People could look in, walk in, see that the Alice Paul Suffs weren't two-headed clawed monsters, just intelligent, civic-minded women. In the past few days, White had also designed her ground game, or at least the first phase of it, determining her officers' placement in the field. She could count them on one hand, certainly not the 15 staffers she'd initially requested, but they were the best, no amateurs. White's team was composed of the party's national organizers, its special operations squad, seasoned campaign operatives who'd worked in all the hot ratification states. White was placing Anita Pollitzer in the Republican stronghold of East Tennessee. Betty Graham would go to Memphis and the West Division. Catherine Flanagan would target the candidates running for seats in the special election, making a base in the northeast corner of the state. Each would have to cover a lot of ground, talk to the men who counted, and convince the men who pulled the strings. This was where Miss Sue's deep knowledge of her home state would be invaluable. Sue White had traveled far in the past 2 years, farther than she could ever have imagined, from the life she'd expected to live in Tennessee. Enlisting in the party had taken her around the country, placed her in the vanguard of a great national crusade, and deposited her into the bosom of an eclectic community of idealistic and adventurous, fearless women from every part of the nation. These past 2 years had changed her, not in a fundamental way. She was still Sunny Miss Sue, but in a profound way nevertheless. Opened her eyes and opened the world. Her roots were still in Tennessee, but for now it was just her place of assignment, her duty post, where Miss Paul had sent her on a mission. She couldn't think or plan beyond that. As soon as ratification was completed, if it was completed, the party and Sue White would have to make some major decisions about the future. The issues were already being debated among the staff. When woman suffrage was finally secured, should the party disband? Its work done? Should it transform itself into a political party of women, advocating for issues important to women, promoting women for elected office, fielding its own candidates? Or should it turn its energies toward winning equal rights for women in other societal matters, like equal pay and economic independence, access to education and professions, divorce and custody rights? White wanted to be part of that discussion, wanted to help make those decisions, but first she had to win Tennessee. Now Governor Roberts's enemies were whispering to her that he had no intention of actually calling the special session, that he was stalling until it would be too late. According to these informants, his anti-advisors now had the upper hand and had convinced him his election prospects hinged on keeping women out. He'd announced the special election to fill vacancies, but not the special session. Very suspicious. White wrote directly to Governor Roberts, reporting that uncomfortable questions about his intentions were circulating around the Capitol, and the only way to quell them was to confirm his commitment to ratification in the special session. She stopped short of openly demanding he quit dawdling and officially announce the session, but that message was clear between the lines. When White dressed that morning in a room at the Tulane, she pushed the sharp point of a pin through the fabric of her blouse, just at the V where the lapels crossed. The small silver rectangle was her most treasured possession. She had earned the pin on a Sunday afternoon in early February 1919, at the front gates of the White House. The war was over, and after more than a year of stalling, the Senate was going to vote on the federal amendment the next day. The amendment was expected to go down in defeat, one vote short. President Wilson was in Paris negotiating the peace treaty, making flowery pronouncements about democracy, assuring a delegation of French women, who wanted women's suffrage to be included in the peace terms, that he favored women's enfranchisement around the world. But Wilson wasn't doing much to prove it at home, the Woman's Party complained, and wasn't working hard enough to wrangle that last recalcitrant Democratic senator needed to pass the amendment before the 65th Congress adjourned. Wilson seemed willing to let the amendment die again. Since New Year's Day, 1919, the Woman's Party had been using a new publicity tactic, lighting watchfires of freedom in Lafayette Park across from the White House, small bonfires contained in Grecian-style urns, in which the president's lofty words about democracy and freedom were ceremonially burned. All through January and early February, the watchfires burned night and day, guarded by shifts of suffragists, fed with replenishments of wood, paper, and the words of Woodrow Wilson relayed from Paris. Rowdy men and boys repeatedly tipped the urns and spilled the fires. Policemen tried to extinguish them, but the women promptly rekindled the flames. The women were arrested on spurious charges, such as lighting fires in a public place after sunset. Upon refusing to pay a fine, they were sent to jail. Insisting they were political prisoners, not common criminals, they launched hunger strikes in the jailhouse. After being released, many of the women went right back to their posts guarding the watchfires, and soon returned to jail. The spectacle of scores of women being hauled off in paddy wagons while the president was in Paris negotiating world peace was embarrassing, and the democratically controlled Senate finally agreed to bring the amendment to the floor on February 10th. But it was clear that the last Democratic vote needed could not be shaken loose. Woodrow Wilson was not negotiating hard enough to win that vote from within his own party, Alice Paul insisted. And so, on the eve of the Senate vote, she turned up the watchfire's heat. Paul called for delegations from around the country to gather in Washington for a special demonstration and told them to be prepared to go to jail. She asked Sue White to play the leading role in the ceremony, burning President Wilson in effigy. Not just his words, but a likeness of him. This had never been done before in any suffrage protest. It was a step beyond, a highly provocative move. White suffrage mentor in Memphis, civic reformer Lulu Collier Reese, who was in sympathy with the Woman's Party methods of direct action, was nervous about this drastic ploy and pleaded with White not to participate. Reese feared not only for White's safety, but for the backlash she'd surely face in Tennessee and consequent damage to the suffrage cause in the state. "It was the most difficult thing I was ever asked to do," Miss Sue admitted. "The greatest sacrifice I have ever made, and nothing but the deepest conviction could have moved me to do it." It was an initiation rite. She understood that, Miss Paul's test of her loyalty and commitment. White deliberated and fretted, but finally decided to answer Paul's summons. She arrived in Washington a few days before the demonstration to rehearse the ritual she was expected to perform. At 4:30 in the afternoon, with dusk nearing, A silent procession of 75 women from 22 states marched out the door of party headquarters and headed across Lafayette Square toward the White House. Leading the parade was Louisine Havemeyer, holding high the American flag, followed by the Woman's Party colors, and then a column of picketers holding banners with such sentiments as, "The President is responsible for the betrayal of American womanhood," and "President Wilson is deceiving the world." Following these were a pair of women carrying an earthenware urn between them, and then a brigade carrying kerosene-soaked wooden logs and kindling in their arms. They placed the urn on the sidewalk in front of the White House gates, with an honor guard surrounding it. An estimated 2,000 spectators were gathered on Pennsylvania Avenue to watch this little drama of democracy, along with 100 policemen, a phalanx of fire extinguishers, and a troop of Boy Scouts assigned to help keep order. Mrs. Havemeyer planted her flag and began her speech. This was Havemeyer's first and only experience in a picketing demonstration. She'd always told Miss Paul, "No picketing and no prison for me. I don't like the thought of either one." But when Paul asked her to join this special protest, she couldn't refuse. "Bring your valise," Paul advised Havemeyer, packed with a warm cloak and a bottle of disinfectant. Mrs. Havemeyer carried her bag out of her Fifth Avenue mansion, telling her family she was just visiting friends in Washington for a few days. Havemeyer's heart was beating fast, and she had to struggle to retain her poise as the party protesters assembled inside headquarters. But once she stepped out with the flag, she instantly felt as placid and calm as if I were going out to play croquet on a summer afternoon. At the White House gates, her booming voice rose above the crowd. "Every Anglo-Saxon government in the world has enfranchised its women. In Russia, in Hungary, in Austria, in Germany itself, the women are completely enfranchised. And 34 are now sitting in the Reichstag," she said, as a red-faced police captain, his uniform adorned with gold braids and buttons, stared at her. "We women of America are assembled here today to voice our deep indignation that, while such efforts are being made to establish democracy in Europe, American women are still deprived of a voice in their government here at home." While Havemeyer was speaking, the urn was lit and the flames rose high. Sue White stepped up to the burning cauldron, holding the president's effigy. The newspapers described the effigy as a huge doll stuffed with straw, slightly over 2 feet in height, but it was no such thing. This effigy was not the traditional stuffed dummy, but a paper doll with the figure of Wilson drawn in black ink, depicting him delivering one of his empty freedom speeches, with a woman's head chained to his belt. White nodded to Havemeyer, then dropped the paper doll into the flames. There was a flash. The police rushed toward White, wielding their extinguishers, trying to rescue the effigy, but it was quickly consumed. Before the police could reach her, White began reciting her statement of purpose. "We burn not the effigy of the president of a free people, but the leader of an autocratic party organization whose tyrannical power holds millions of women in political slavery," she shouted, as the police doused the urn and grabbed her arm. "I have long been what is known as a Southern Democrat, and the traditions of the democracy of Jefferson and Jackson are still strong in my heart," she yelled, as burly men in blue coats hustled her to one of the many waiting Black Maria patrol wagons. "The stronger, because I feel that it is what we are fighting for now. Mr. Wilson, as the leader of his party, has forgotten, or else he never knew, the spirit of true democracy," White screamed over the din of the commotion. "We feel that there is need of a determined protest of this sort,
A protest which will shock Mr. Wilson and his followers into putting into action the principle that those who submit to authority shall have a voice in their government."
The last words were inaudible as Sue White was pushed into the patrol wagon. The scene turned chaotic, with policemen surging forward, spraying the women with fire extinguishers, arresting as many of the protesters as they could capture, assisted in the chase by the loyal Boy Scouts. In the midst of the melee, Mrs. Havemeyer was assigned another task, one designed to get her arrested. Lucy Burns, in charge of the afternoon's demonstration, handed Havemeyer bundles of paper to light with a match and throw into the urn.
"Please, Miss Burns," the police captain begged, "don't let her do it. You know we don't want to take her. Please don't."
The police felt queasy dragging off a grandmotherly protester. Havemeyer knew she must qualify for the prison special railroad tour by actually going to prison, so she kept throwing the bundles into the fire. Still, the captain hesitated.
"I believe I will have to kick him to keep in the game," Havemeyer whispered to Burns.
But finally the policeman placed a hand on Havemeyer's shoulder, looped his arm through hers, and guided her to the Black Maria. In a caravan of patrol wagons and commandeered cars, Mrs. Havemeyer, Sue White, Lucy Burns, and 36 other party women were driven to the station house. The police seemed nervous about the mass arrest. The commander telephoned the White House and spoke to Joseph Tumulty, the president's secretary. The women were held overnight in the police dormitory and arraigned the next afternoon. The charges were strange. For lighting a fire, for carrying wood to a fire, for incitement. Since burning the president in effigy wasn't actually a crime, Sue White was charged with lighting combustibles on White House grounds. Havemeyer was found guilty of striking a match. The judge gave each woman a choice. A $5 fine, or 5 days in jail. "Of course, no one thought of paying the fine," Mrs. Havemeyer recalled proudly. The women were sentenced just at the hour the Senate was voting down the amendment. The Occoquan Workhouse was a decrepit, foul-smelling, vermin-infested jail, closed down a decade before as unfit to hold humans. The women entered dark, damp cells, each equipped with what Havemeyer described as a disgusting closet, an iron support for a straw bed, one chair, and no light. The bed straw was dirty, the sewage vapors nauseating, the cells bitter cold. Rats and cockroaches scurried on every surface. The women, hunger-striking, didn't touch the tins of soup or wormy bread set before them. Still, the conditions were better, and the sentences much shorter than the 6- and 7-month ordeals, often in solitary confinement, suffered by Alice Paul and other party women. Mrs. Havemeyer's family in New York was horrified by the news that she was in jail, and they insisted she pay her fine, leave her comrades, and return home immediately. She resisted at first. They told her that the grandchildren were crying for her, and her sister was deathly ill. How could she be so cruel? She sent word to Miss Paul, who gave her permission to pay her fine and leave. She still qualified for the prison special. When Sue White and the others were released after their 5-day sentence and hunger strike, she returned, weak and wobbly, to party headquarters on Lafayette Square, and was confined to bed. It was a brief convalescence. The next day she was on her feet to receive her prison pin in a little ceremony. Every woman who was jailed for freedom, there were almost 150 of them by then, was decorated with a distinguished service pin by Miss Paul. She'd been awarded one by Mrs. Pankhurst in England after she'd endured her first imprisonment for suffrage activities there, and she carried on the tradition in the Woman's Party. The pin was a miniature of a jail door, modeled on the doors of Holloway Prison in London, gridded by little silver bars, draped with a chain of tiny links, secured by a diminutive heart-shaped lock. It was so precise a replica that even the door's hinges and bolts, the lock's keyhole, and the narrow slit in the bars for passing food to the prisoner were distinct. No diamond could ever mean more to Sue White. The pin marked Sue's total break with the moderate Tennessee suffragists. Condemnation of the effigy burning was swift and ferocious. Speaking for the National, Molly Hay slammed the Woman's Party stunt, saying it makes us question whether they want the success of the amendment or publicity for the organization. And she denounced the party as the IWW of the suffrage movement, tarring it with the brush of the radical, violent, and mostly despised industrial workers of the world. Carrie Catt also lashed out. If the women of America are betrayed, it will not be by the president. A vote for the amendment is a vote for what the president wants. A vote against the amendment is a vote for what the Woman's Party wants. More punishing still was the contempt of White's Tennessee suffrage colleagues. Joining the Alice Paul group was one thing. Symbolically incinerating the president, a Southerner, a Democrat, was quite another. It was unpatriotic and perhaps even treasonous. And with a bill to win partial suffrage for Tennessee women pending in the legislature in the winter of 1919, the mainstream Tennessee suffs deeply resented the damage that Miss Sue's inflammatory indulgences might inflict on their campaign. A few weeks later, when that suffrage bill was being debated in the State House, Sue White's name and her notorious act were invoked time and again by those opposed to woman suffrage. Legislators advocating the bill on the floor took pains to note that White did not in any way represent the sentiment of Tennessee suffragists. She became the symbol of hysterical suffrage zealotry. She didn't care. White believed she was a true daughter of Susan B. Anthony, who had understood the power of direct action to bring attention to injustice. When Miss Anthony cast her defiant ballot in the election of 1872, and when she disrupted the official 4th of July ceremonies at the 1876 Centennial Exhibition in Philadelphia, by barging up to the podium and presenting her Declaration of Rights of the Women of the United States, she knew she wasn't being polite. When she climbed onto that bandstand in front of Independence Hall and read the angry declaration and its list of grievances aloud to a startled audience, Miss Anthony was most definitely defying the rules of ladylike society. The Woman's Party was heir to Anthony's indomitable spirit, Sue White was convinced. It kept the flame of her honorable, non-violent militancy burning bright. And there was that other Susan, her namesake, her aunt, who had also taught her to take a stand, even if it was not a public stand, if it was only an act of principle. Her own Aunt Susan had broken the law, defied society and her father, by secretly teaching the family's slaves to read. Aunt Susan had been a clandestine abolitionist, Sue learned years later, when her elderly relative confessed it all to her. And her aunt also admitted she'd always admired Susan Anthony for her outspoken support for abolition. Her aunt's revelation was all slightly shocking to young Sue, but galvanizing. It was a small action, a private defiance, but it made a deep impression on Sue and guided her in moments of decision. She knew it was a risk to wear her prison pin in Tennessee, but she would wear it, brazenly, proudly, every day. Anita Politzer was only 25 years old, but she was already a seasoned veteran of the suffrage wars. She could drop into a new territory, scan the terrain quickly, and map its political contours effortlessly. Much the way a quick sketch artist can draw the basic shapes and lines of a scene, capturing the essence of the whole. Politzer's powers of political observation were enhanced by her own artistic training. Politzer was an artist who traded her brushes and charcoals for the picket poles and train tickets of a Woman's Party crusader. Unlike many women who joined the movement, Politzer enjoyed the support of her family, who encouraged her work. She was no rebel to them. She was the adored youngest daughter of a prosperous Charleston cotton merchant family, pillars of the city's thriving Jewish community. The Pollitzer's parlor on fashionable Pitt Street was filled with music and art, and very often it was also filled with meetings on progressive social and political themes, especially women's rights. Anita's two older sisters were both active suffragists. Anita grew up assuming that working for the cause was a natural thing for a proper young woman to do. Anita went north to Teachers College of Columbia University in New York City to study art and education. She took painting classes at the Art Students League and became good friends with a moody but talented classmate named Georgia O'Keeffe. They were very different personalities. Pollitzer optimistic and ebullient, O'Keeffe sullen and self-absorbed. But they shared a love of art and a thirst for all things modern and bold. They hung out at photographer Alfred Stieglitz's gallery at 291 Fifth Avenue, where they had their first exposure to the paintings of Pablo Picasso, Georges Braque, and John Maron. When O'Keeffe left New York for a succession of unsatisfying teaching jobs, Pollitzer kept her connected to the New York City art world with long newsy letters, art magazines, and poems for inspiration. O'Keeffe replied with introspective notes and packages of her latest drawings and paintings. When Pollitzer opened her college mailbox in early 1916 to find a particularly striking set of O'Keeffe charcoal drawings, she disobeyed her friend's instructions to keep them private and went downtown to show them to Stieglitz, and he was impressed. "At last, a woman on paper," he famously exclaimed, and began displaying O'Keeffe's work in his gallery and promoting her talent. Stieglitz and O'Keeffe would later marry. Pollitzer changed the course of O'Keeffe's life and career, but she chose a totally different path for herself. At home in Charleston on her summer vacations, Pollitzer joined her sisters in suffrage work, helping to proselytize and organize. She did everything from drawing recruitment posters to selling lemonade to debating antis on the street. In New York, she wore a cap and gown to march with the collegiate contingent in the great October 1915 suffrage parade down Fifth Avenue, writing excitedly to O'Keeffe about the tremendous affair with tens of thousands of participants. When her sisters grew frustrated with the national slow pace of suffrage progress in the South, they signed on with the Woman's Party and its more aggressive agenda, and Anita joined them in that camp. Soon after Pollitzer graduated from college in 1916, she moved to Washington to work for the party. She was a silent sentinel on the steps of the U.S. Capitol in the fall of 1918, holding a banner protesting the Senate's refusal to act on the federal amendment. America enters the peace conference with unclean hands, for democracy is denied to her people. She and her fellow picketers were treated roughly by the police, knocked down, shaken, dragged down the Senate steps. It only stiffened her resolve. Though she'd been arrested, she never served time, so she didn't own a prison pin. When the ratification campaign began, Miss Paul frequently sent Pollitzer to Capitol Hill to convince a reluctant congressman or senator to apply pressure on his state's governor or legislature to ratify. She did her homework before approaching her assigned prey. She sweetly asked pointed questions. She was a good listener and had a brilliant smile. But she learned not to trust any politician's promise of aid. She stood over his shoulder while he telephoned or wired his colleagues back home, making sure the task was accomplished in her presence. The petite Pollitzer might appear an ingenue, but gullibility was not one of her traits, and gumption was. Alice Paul recognized her potential and dispatched her to organize and lobby in the states, Wyoming, Florida, Virginia, and more, where she mastered the art of persistent persuasion. Pollitzer loved the work. It was like being a soldier, spy, and agitator all rolled into one. Her job was to find things out and shake things up. She often worked in a team with Sue White, Betty Graham, or Catherine Flanagan, and she was tickled to think they'd now be reunited for the big push in Tennessee. She was ready. Her first stop was Chattanooga, where she was to meet with former U.S. Senator Newell Sanders, a loyal suffragist whose confidence Pulitzer was eager to gain. Sanders was a courtly gentleman, 70 years old, with soft, droopy eyes, who might be taken for a kindly country minister. He was actually a shrewd businessman and canny politician, respected throughout the state. He sat Pulitzer down at his kitchen table, his wife puttering nearby, and spent the entire afternoon giving his guest a crash course in Tennessee Republican politics. He explained the different factions, the splits, the feuds, the issues, the bosses, and who gave orders to whom. She listened attentively, fixing her gray eyes upon him, scribbling in a notebook on her lap. Pulitzer had a knack for getting powerful men to talk freely. The startling combination of a vivacious brunette who could knowledgeably talk shop with an old Paul, and seemed delighted to do so for hours at a time, enchanted more than a few flinty backroom characters, turning them into valuable informants. And when she was working in the southern states, it certainly didn't hurt that Pulitzer spoke with the honeyed accent of a Charleston girl. Sanders briefed her on which Republicans she needed to reach, which men might try to dodge her, which might cause trouble. The first man to tackle was Jesse Littleton, Sanders told her, the former mayor of Chattanooga, now running for the Republican gubernatorial nomination. Littleton was a wet, an attorney representing liquor interests, and he had power over a significant Republican faction. He was a kingpin. A few hours later, Pulitzer was facing Jesse Littleton in his Chattanooga office. Pulitzer took an instant dislike to Littleton. "He is a slick, cox-like politician. Only he wears white and weighs 300 pounds, she reported to Paul. "He appears to be friendly," Pulitzer concluded, "but his face does such queer things when I pin him down." Pulitzer was now on a train from Chattanooga to Athens, chugging along the ridges of the Appalachian foothills, to find Tennessee Senate Republican floor leader Herschel Candler, who'd voted no on limited woman suffrage last year. "We must make effort to get Candler, as he leads men," she wrote to Alice Paul. "He will hurt us unless he can be convinced." First, she was going to see Candler's friends in his hometown of Athens. Then, if possible, Candler himself. Then Candler's protege, Harry Byrne, a Republican representative from the town of Niota. Down the political food chain. It was the only way. As her train approached Athens, Pulitzer dashed off the last of her letter to Paul and, like Sue White, complained about Carrie Catt's claims of a ratification majority, scribbling her own expression of outrage. "The papers are full of Mrs. Catt," she wrote. "Today she comes out saying, 'We have more than majority pledged in both houses.' And I had, before I took train, to see my men to explain we haven't. And they had to work." Mrs. Catt was pouring cold water on the fire Anita Pulitzer was trying so hard to kindle under the East Tennessee Republicans, giving them too easy an excuse to sit back and twiddle their thumbs. Catt was a menace, Pulitzer was convinced, complicating an already difficult mission. "The Republicans are not going to be easy," she wrote to Miss Paul, underlining the words "not" and "easy" in bold strokes. Pulitzer's colleague Hayden Rector, who was handling the Woman's Party's negotiations with both the Cox and the Harding camps in Ohio, was also livid when she saw the front-page headlines heralding Catt's claim of victory in Tennessee. "We must not have all our work and efforts brought to nothing like this," Rector told Alice Paul, excoriating Catt. "Her determination to end the fight in people's minds is simply satanic." Chapter 14. Fieldwork. The dog days of summer, when July melts into August, was, in any normal Tennessee year, a quiet and restful time when the pace of life slowed. But this was no ordinary summer. An abnormally hot weather frenzy gripped the state, as the intersecting trajectories of multiple political campaigns and suffrage missions etched zigzagging, crisscrossing, overlapping, and parallel trails across the map. Carrie Catt was traveling eastward from Memphis to Knoxville to Chattanooga. Sue White was spiraling around Nashville, making quick trips into nearby towns to snag important legislators. Josephine Pearson was shuttling between the Hotel Hermitage and various planning meetings around Nashville, while Nina Pinkard zipped into the offices of prominent Tennessee attorneys, and Charlotte Rao ventured to other cities to stoke anti-sentiment. Governor Roberts and his rivals, there were at least five other gubernatorial hopefuls, and their surrogates were snaking through every county. Dozens of candidates running for vacant seats in the legislature were campaigning in their districts, accompanied by their supporters. The League of Women Voters members were still combing the countryside, climbing up hills and plunging down into haulers to pledge laggard legislators. Women's Party organizers were embedded in all three grand divisions, chasing after the region's legislators and politicians. With just 10 days until the state primary, which might determine the fate of ratification in Tennessee, everyone was in motion. This was the fieldwork of democracy, the tough, sweaty, unglamorous enterprise of retail politics. Before the advent of radio or television broadcasting, this was how candidates won elections. But it was also how, over the years, the suffragists had slowly, methodically built a constituency for change, selling their radical concept door-to-door, town-to-town. Pageants and parades were fun. They caught public attention and energized the troops, but the real work was always accomplished on the ground. Canvasses and petition campaigns, small meetings and personal pleas, knocking on doors. Only after that sort of cultivation had been accomplished, only when the constituency for women's suffrage had expanded, from a few women around a tea table to millions around the country, reached critical mass, and attained a robust voice, could the suffrage argument be advanced, carried into politicians' offices, subsequently hoisted onto legislative dockets, and finally presented as a fundamental alteration to the national constitution. Women had done all that over the span of decades, but now it was back into the field for the final stage, with both suffs and antis scrambling for advantage, with the clock ticking. Such was the natural physiology of change within a democracy, and the process was now being put to a stress test in the fields of Tennessee. Mr. Crump wanted women to vote. He wanted the amendment ratified, and Mr. Crump gave the orders in Memphis. Carrie Catt was very pleased. It made her work in the city much easier. Edward Hull Crump ran the Democratic Party machine in Shelby County, which includes Memphis. He was 45 years old, with cup-handle ears that sprang out from his head, wavy red hair, a deeply cleft chin, and bushy eyebrows over intense eyes. Scrappy was the word that best described him. He grew up poor, married well, used his native smarts to make money and climb the political ladder quickly. He was elected mayor of Memphis, Tennessee's largest city, in 1909 when he was just 35 years old. He ran the city like a business, with an efficient administration and customer service approach, keeping a tight budget while improving public services. But when Crump repeatedly refused to enforce the state's prohibition laws, knowing the liquor ban would harm his city's lucrative industry of saloons, gambling parlors, and music joints, the temperance-inclined governor and legislature passed a special ouster law, kicking him out of office. His removal didn't diminish his political influence. He simply shifted his center of power to Shelby County and ruled the city from there. Crump was a political boss with progressive leanings, or at least he embraced those progressive measures that could enhance his power. Crump couldn't give a speech to save his life, but he had a genius for organization and an ability to work with different constituencies. Give something, get something, everybody wins. Memphis was home to the largest black community in the state, and Crump considered this group a valuable and voting constituency with whom he forged alliances. He was a traditional segregationist, But when the black community requested a city park of their own, they were forbidden to enter the other, grander parks in town under Jim Crow statutes. Crump listened and obliged. In return, he expected, or demanded, black men's support at the polls. He made it easy. His organization paid the poll taxes for many black men and got them to the voting booths. They voted the Crump organization ticket. He, in turn, improved their neighborhoods. Black community leaders such as businessman Robert Church Jr., brother of suffragist and civil rights activist Mary Church Terrell, often found Crump a helpful ally. It was, as later politicians would describe it, a win-win transaction. A large new block of voters, white women and black women, was enticing to Crump. It didn't hurt that Mrs. Crump was a strong suffragist, too. Was the arm-twisting, horse-trading, brutal and bruising political world of Boss Crump the paradigm of democracy Carrie Catt had promised to American women? No, but it was the real world of politics. Women's entry might sanitize, elevate, and improve it. Might. But women must at least take part. And, as she'd learned through many a campaign, especially dealing with Tammany Hall in New York, if the local political machine could be harnessed for your good, if it could help carry women toward enfranchisement, be willing to take the ride. When Carrie Catt arrived in Memphis, she was happy for Boss Crump's support. Catt enjoyed a warm welcome to the city when her train arrived in the early morning. At a noontime Chamber of Commerce luncheon, more than 150 women and men, leaders of the city's suffrage establishment, as well as members of the political and civic elite, gave her a long, glassware-rattling ovation. Even more significant, the local politicians were lining up solidly behind ratification, with no apparent qualms or equivocations. She'd barely had to nudge. They were already on her side. It was remarkable. It was due to Mr. Crump. To the suffragists' delight, Crump was taking strong measures to guarantee that the Shelby County Democrats would not only vote as a bloc, but also take the lead in promoting ratification in the legislature. He'd persuaded Thomas Riddick, a respected Memphis attorney, to run for one of the vacant legislative seats to serve in the special session. Political observers were shocked. Million-dollar Riddick, he had a very lucrative private practice, had often been mentioned as a candidate for governor, congressman, or U.S. senator, but not for a lowly seat in the Tennessee House of Representatives. But when it was revealed that Boss Crump would serve as Riddick's campaign manager, it all made sense. Crump was placing Riddick in the special session to be his surrogate, keep the Memphis-Shelby delegation in line, and guide ratification efforts. For the Suffs, it was a happy prospect. While Carrie Catt was in Memphis, Josephine Pearson was in a state of ecstatic anticipation. Fulfilling the dreams of her parents, she was marshaling the forces of good to defend Southern and Christian civilization against the barbarians at the gates, against Gog and Magog, against Mrs. Catt and the suffragists. It was a divine mission that suited her perfectly. First, Pearson blew the trumpet, sending out a call for sympathetic helpers to join the anti-effort. She and her colleagues made a broad and clever appeal. Whether you oppose woman suffrage on principle, or approve of suffrage but oppose the federal amendment and Washington trampling on states' rights, we welcome you. If you support ratification of the federal amendment but believe Tennessee legislators would be violating their oaths of office if they voted on ratification in the special session, join us. Building a bigger tent for a wider coalition was a smart move, and the response was enthusiastic. Volunteers quickly formed committees to attend to every task. Letters typed and copied, literature printed and distributed, envelopes stuffed and licked, the headquarters staffed and decorated, teas and receptions prepared. The cream of Nashville society, women from all the best families were Pearson's eager recruits, working selflessly in shifts through the day and evening under her command. Pearson and the other executive officers of the Tennessee Division of the Southern Women's Rejection League, together with Nina Pinkard and Charlotte Rao, also devised a robust political program. Rao would venture out to various Tennessee cities to stoke anti-sentiment in public speeches and private meetings. Pinkard would continue to hammer at the presidential candidates and Governor Roberts. Every Tennessee legislator would be contacted, made painfully aware of his legal and moral obligations to defeat ratification. Dozens of distinguished women from the states that had already rejected the amendment were invited to Nashville, as well as national leaders of the anti-movement. And a delegation of Tennessee women, led by Pearson's colleague Queenie Washington, was prepared to leave for a meeting with James Cox in Dayton the minute he signaled for them to come. He'd said that a meeting would, of course, be granted, but no specific date had yet been set. Josephine Pearson was delighted to give the full measure of her bountiful intellectual and spiritual gifts to these efforts. She took to wearing a little bouquet of 3 red silk roses on her bosom, signifying her leadership status. Anita Politzer continued her manhunt through the Appalachian foothills of East Tennessee, Republican politicos in her sights. Unless she could bring these big men around, the pledges she wrangled from their legislative underlings wouldn't be worth much. She kept a list of important men to see in each town, adding to it every day as those men suggested others. She compiled 2 notebooks filled with names and notes on who could get to whom as she stalked the local movers and shakers and pounced on them in their lairs. When she'd stepped off the train in Athens, the McMinn County seat, she'd headed for the courthouse, the political nerve center of the region. McMinn was Republican territory, as during the War of Secession, the county had voted, narrowly, to remain in the Union. Families and friends were torn apart, as the county sent 12 units of its men to fight for the Union, and 8 units to defend the Confederacy. Politzer visited the Republican county chairman, who sketched for her the personal and professional ties among the party men of McMinn, directing her to see some of the more pivotal players. She compiled a checklist, see Luther, Boyer, Byrne, and Candler, and went after them one by one. Senator Herschel Candler was the most essential, anti-suffrage and influential, a bad combination, but she learned he was out of town. She hired a car to take her into the hills to see Emerson Luther, the Republican House floor leader, and came away with his pledge. She was told that Delegate C. Fulton Boyer was not only too old and stubborn and anti to argue with, but also untrustworthy. "That is polite for scoundrel," she explained to Paul, and decided not to bother finding him. That left Harry Byrne. At 24 years old, freshman Representative Harry Byrne was the youngest member of the legislature. He was, according to everyone Politzer spoke to, earnest and hard-working, well-liked by his constituents and his colleagues in the State House. He lived on his family's land in the hill town of Niota, north and a little west of Athens, supporting his widowed mother and 2 younger siblings. He was a hometown boy making good. He was holding down jobs as a Southern Railway agent and at a local bank while reading law at night under the tutelage of a senior attorney. Everyone said he had the potential to go far. At this stage, he had little clout in the legislature, and he was up for re-election in the fall, but Miss Paul thought he was worth pursuing. He'd voted for presidential suffrage last year, but he hadn't yet revealed his stand on ratification. But getting to Byrne was not going to be easy. Niota was a tiny town, population 467, nestled between wooded ridges. It was less than 10 miles from Athens, and the local train did stop there, but the timetable wouldn't allow Politzer to get there in a timely fashion, and the Byrne place was a long climb from the depot. She couldn't afford to hire another car and driver. It wasn't going to work. Politzer did the next best thing. She asked the helpful Republican county chairman to telephone Byrne. Anyhow, the party chief would wield more clout with the young legislator.
"Oh, sure, Harry will be with you," the party chairman assured Politzer.
"Then why was he still claiming to be uncommitted in all the legislative polls?" she asked.
"Oh, well, Harry's up for re-election, you know. He's got to be careful. He needs to play things close to the vest."
Politzer pressed the chairman to place the call. When the operator at Central put him through, Harry came to the phone.
"Lady here wants to know if you'll be voting to ratify, Harry."
The chairman spoke into the cup of the phone's mouthpiece. There were muffled words coming from Byrne into the chairman's earpiece, but Politzer couldn't make them out. The conversation was brief. The chairman returned the elongated bell of the receiver into its cradle.
"Harry will be all right," he told her.
Harry T. Byrne was marked as pledged to ratify, and Politzer moved on to Knoxville. Carrie Catt barely had time to swallow some dinner before delivering another speech at the suffrage rally in Memphis's Court Avenue Presbyterian Church. She was a talented speaker, able to combine cold logic and warm humor, mixing idealism with how-to practicality. But in truth, the woman renowned around the world for her oratory gifts was, even after decades on the podium, in agony whenever she spoke. She habitually calmed her nerves by clasping and unclasping her hands behind her back, twiddling her fingers, gnashing her thumbs. Only those sitting behind could ever see. Her audiences never knew. Still, Kat was always happiest on the stump, out and doing, revving up the faithful, converting the doubtful, and she felt buoyed by this reception in Memphis. The church was packed. In conjunction with Kat's tour, mass meetings, rallies, and petition drives were also being launched by the League of Women Voters in the state's smaller centers, Tullahoma, Murfreesboro, Mountain City, to bring public pressure to bear upon the legislature. The goal was to make it impossible for any member of the General Assembly to elude the suffragists' grasp as the time of decision neared. In the hours between her speeches, in every city and town on her tour, Kat met privately with the district chairwomen of the local branch of the League of Women Voters to scrutinize the legislative polling data they'd collected. During these meetings with her suffrage field workers, Kat probed beyond the bare numbers to ask blunt questions. In every meeting, she asked, "Are there any known bribable legislators from your district?" There was rarely a response of complete silence. Often the entire group shouted out a name in unison, as the shady reputation of a certain legislator was so well known. Kat posed the same question to the local political leaders, the men behind the scenes, with whom she met privately in each city. The men usually reacted to the query with a startled look of suspicion, which they quickly masked with a blank expression, followed by what Kat called a canny determination not to reveal any names. Kat didn't let them off the hook. Further discussion usually secured the names. Using secret marks on the polling list, Kat corroborated the legislator's name with other reliable people. These suspect lawmakers were not counted in Kat's private tally of likely votes for ratification, even if they'd signed a pledge to do so. They were liable to fall under the sway of a generous anti-lobbyist. Kat kept two sets of books, so to speak. The accounting she gave to the press, which assumed every pledge was sound, and the real one, which took a more jaundiced, realistic view of lawmakers' promises. As Kat and her entourage moved from city to city, she was alarmed to notice more secret marks accumulating next to various delegates' names and the numbers on the suff's pledge tallies softening. In consulting with the local suffragists and party politicians, she noticed a common theme emerging. The violation of oath issue had taken hold, despite all the legal and practical arguments to the contrary. The opinions of former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Charles Evans Hughes, the U.S. and Tennessee Attorney Generals, and all the other big legal names didn't seem to make much of a dent in the opposition. If anything, more Tennessee legislators seemed to be getting spooked by the oath issue. This violation of oath business was simply a smokescreen being used by those who oppose ratification at heart, Kat kept insisting to her audiences and to the press. It was a subterfuge, an excuse. To counter the spreading oath menace, Kat sent orders to Nashville to launch a broader effort to refute the anti-claims. Squads of suffrage friends, both women and men, visited the law offices of respected attorneys in their districts, urging them to endorse the favorable legal opinions already in hand, or write one of their own. The Suffs built a healthy roster of notable attorneys supporting ratification, but the Antis were recruiting their own all-star team of lawyers to take their side. Nina Pinkard and Charlotte Rao were ushered into the plush offices of some of Nashville's finest law firms, escorted by a staff member of the American Constitutional League. They carried introductions not only from prominent local attorneys such as John Vertrees and several Vanderbilt University